It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a child psychiatrist who uses telepsychiatry to reach patients remotely in Wisconsin. It's one solution being used to address a shortage of mental health care in rural parts of the state.
First, we're talking about the latest news from this week's attacks on Paris and how they'll affect American foreign policy.
Last Friday, those coordinated attacks in Paris killed 129 people, injured more than 300 others. In response to the attacks, the French president declared a state of emergency.
Authorities have said that the people responsible for the attack have links to the Islamic State, and details are still emerging about the terrorists involved.
On Sunday, France unleashed massive airstrikes on the group's headquarters in Syria, and we learned today that American warplanes have destroyed more than 100 of the group's oil trucks.
Joining us now to talk more about how America and other Western nations will respond to these attacks is Don Heider Markle, professor of political science at the University of Kansas. Don, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Don, what did the American military strategy against ISIS look like before these attacks on Paris?
It's largely been a containment strategy and recapturing some of the territory that ISIS has captured in Iraq and then whittling them down in Syria.
And was France involved in those plans, in that containment?
They have been involved, but in recent months they've sort of scaled back their activities until this weekend, of course, and now they seem determined to continue with a barrage of airstrikes.
So given that France has been less involved in those efforts, why do you think the attackers chose France, targeted France, for these really horrific attacks?
Well, really, all Western countries are basically in Europe and the United States and Canada who have been involved in any way in fighting against ISIS in Syria and Iraq are really targets for ISIS. And for the most part, ISIS has laid out a plan over the past 3 years to suggest that once they move to consolidate their territory in Iraq and Syria, that they will target external targets in the West, with Russia and with regimes in the Middle East and North Africa that they believe to be corrupt.
So certainly a lot of attention is paid when attacks succeed, but there are also attacks that are thwarted that the public doesn't ever learn about. Have there been ISIS attacks in France or elsewhere recently that we know were detected in advance and stopped as a result?
In the UK, in France, and in Belgium, as well as in Germany over the past 12 months, there have been a number of arrests, and the total information about those arrests and the plans that the individuals had haven't been entirely clear, but at least with some of what occurred in the attacks in Paris, we can easily understand that the network available to ISIS actors in Europe is perhaps larger than we thought it was.
Well, and there was not very long ago at all the incident on the train from Amsterdam to France where civilians that were traveling on the train were able to overpower an attacker. Do we know if that, for instance, was linked to this network?
That would be a little uncertain. What was interesting about the Paris attacks that's different from much of what's occurred in the United States and Canada and in Europe to this point is that this seemed to be a mix of individuals who were basically homegrown and some who had at least traveled abroad and may have come from abroad to engage in and plan these attacks. And most of what we've seen prior to this has largely been homegrown activity or self-radicalized individuals who decide to carry out an attack on their own without necessarily much, if any, communication with ISIS Central.
We're talking with Don Heider Markle. He's a professor of political science at the University of Kansas. We're talking about potential reactions and responses from the West to the recent terror attacks that have been pinned on ISIL. And so, as we mentioned, both France and the U.S. have bombed Islamic State targets in the past 2 days. What do we know about the specific targets that they're hitting?
These are targets that would have been on the list for some time. Part of the problem with targeting ISIS strong points in both Iraq and Syria is that we go through a process of sort of making sure that civilians won't be harmed, that these are in fact solely ISIS-controlled areas, and that sort of the so-called moderate rebels in Syria, for example, will not be targeted, as well as civilians. And that takes quite a bit of time and requires some level of ground intelligence. In other words, we can't just do it with drones and satellite technology. We have to have people on the ground somewhere that can check things out in order to make sure that there's not a lot of residual casualties. So that takes time. So these probably had been recently cleared. Why they weren't even targeted, say, 3 days ago versus waiting until Saturday isn't entirely clear. But the targets in Syria pose a much bigger challenge for France and for the United States than do many targets in Iraq.
So similarly to having known what targets would immediately be used in retaliation by French and the U.S., so the French police have executed more than 160 raids across the country and in Belgium over the last couple of days. So it seems like they had a list of potentially suspect areas or people's homes. Why wouldn't they have gone to those earlier?
Right, and I'm sure there's not, for many of those individuals, there's not a lot of direct evidence that they had plans or were intending to commit criminal acts. They have just been on monitoring lists for a variety of reasons. Perhaps they had traveled to Syria or elsewhere in recent years, maybe even fought in Iraq or Syria, but hadn't actually been found. The investigations hadn't led to evidence that they were about to or planning to engage in criminal acts. So that's how they ended up on those lists. And I suspect a lot of those individuals will have to be released at some point, that it will be difficult to bring any kind of formal charges against them. But the problem of especially foreign fighters and self-radicalized individuals has been a much bigger deal in Europe compared to the United States, partly because they've had more people travel to Syria and Iraq to fight. And they have also, the Muslim communities in those countries are less integrated into the broader societies than they are, say, in the United States and Canada.
So today at the G20 summit in Turkey, President Obama said sending ground forces into Syria isn't the answer. Here's his explanation for that.
It is not just my view, but the view of my closest military and civilian advisors, that that would be a mistake.
So what do we think the next step on behalf of the U.S. and its allies will be?
Well, I'm sure the bombing campaigns will continue. The bigger question is, will there be a greater effort to, for example, bring more Kurdish fighters into the battle in Syria, to use more special operations forces, be they U.S. forces or French or other forces, to try to find the targets that we're looking for in Syria and to some extent in Iraq as well. That strategy will probably continue to expand, and our support by dropping weapons and supplies to moderate forces, and in particular trying to help out the Kurdish fighters that are already fighting in Syria and Iraq, to continue trying to support them at higher levels than we did in the past.
Well, Don, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was political science professor Don Heider-Markle discussing how American foreign policy might change after the recent terrorist attacks on Paris.
Mental health care around the country is facing a shortage. With the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, more people are insured. Insurers are now required to cover mental health care. That means demand is going up.
At the same time, psychiatrists are retiring faster than medical schools are producing them. The shortage is even more dramatic in rural areas, including many parts of Wisconsin.
One of the answers to this lack of providers in rural areas is telepsychiatry. Psychiatrists from urban areas can meet with patients in other parts of the state by video conferencing with them.
Veronica Rickert sat down with Dr. Richard Barthel to talk about how it all works and the challenges of telemedicine. He's a child psychiatrist and assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he uses telepsychiatry to meet with patients in Appleton from his office in Wauwatosa.
Paint us a picture, if you would. How does telepsychiatry work?
Telepsychiatry is simply a method to connect with people at a distance and to provide services that have both an audio and visual component. Of course, there can't be any touching over the screen, but that's the main use of telepsychiatry. It's best for sharing data, and that's why it started out with the use of x-rays at a distance and MRIs and echoes and all those other things that can be knocked down into bits and then sent over distance so people can reconstruct them. But now we use it in telepsychiatry, particularly to see patients at a distance and to interact with them over time and space.
Now, when you're talking about seeing patients on a screen, is it your basic size computer screen or is it something larger?
Well, you can do both. Some people use a computer screen. I find it more useful to have a large HD screen in my office. And, of course, the family has an HD screen at the other end of the clinic that I work in.
So what kinds of services do you provide to patients using this kind of telepsychiatry?
My services are just to children and adolescents. But obviously I see families as part of that. And all of the work that I do and have been doing for the last 6 years is to do medication management and evaluation of initial problems.
Now, is there any difference that you feel that you think the patients feel when they're communicating with you via a screen instead of there in the office in person? Are there any nuances that get missed or is this fitting the bill?
Well, I think there's two different ways to approach that, one of which is from the side that the family is on, and it really depends on the age of the child and their experience with other digital modes to communicate. A vast majority of children that I see and families that I see have had experience with talking to relatives at a distance, fathers overseas, mothers in a different spot, over instruments like their computer Skype or their iPhone or whatever it is that they're using. So from their point of view, I think that it's pretty similar that they've done this before. The arresting thing is the fact that it's a huge screen and that the person is actually talking directly to them. From my end, I think that the major dilemma for me, and I say this to everybody that I talk with about it, is that focal length is the issue. Because, for example, if I'm seeing a child who has a tic disorder, subtle movements of their face, hands, arms, extremities, belly, then I can use my focal length to cone in on the face, and I'll see good, clear interactions in terms of what facial tics they may have, but I'll miss what is happening in the rest of their body. On the other hand, if I go back and look at the full body picture, then I'm missing what's going on in the face. But that's a pretty subtle distinction. And most of the time, just a fixed focal length, which shows from the knees up when the parent, when the child or the parent is sitting down, is just fine. The only problem I have in most families, and it seems like it's mostly dads, is that when they come in, they're wearing their Packer baseball cap, and then I have to take it off to make sure that they have good lighting on their face.
I see.
But they're usually pretty okay with that.
Now, telepsychiatry is something that's happening more and more often in Wisconsin and elsewhere, I gather, as well. In your words, can you explain to us why we need this, why people are using telepsychiatry?
I believe the main reason is because it saves people travel. It's a geographical extender. In my situation, it's a geographic extender, and it's also because the clinic that I work with has not been able to recruit a child psychiatrist to see people in person, and so I've been supporting them for a number of years. And in fact, I think if they're able to recruit somebody who can see the patients in office, then probably I would lose my position. But it is an extender in terms of geography. For example, the VA system across the country, and particularly in Wisconsin, have been using the extension of telepsychiatry for a number of years to see people in the upper part of the state where there are no clinics.
Right, and what you're getting at here is a coverage gap. It sounds as though there's a shortage of mental health care providers in general, and that there's also a rural coverage gap. As you said, sometimes not any providers available in a particular area. How is that playing out here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's been in Wisconsin and most other states the same, that there's a clustering of mental health professionals, particularly physicians, in a city area because it's harder to attract them to a distant space. Now, I work for the Medical College of Wisconsin, and as you probably are aware, the Medical College has recently expanded into two branch campuses, one in the Green Bay area and one in the north-central part of the state. But so that's going to probably bring more physicians to the area because they'll have a commitment to educating the next group of physicians. But on the other hand, it's hard to sustain people in smaller cities when the physicians and their families are more wanting to be involved in larger areas. So the geography distribution is an issue, and that's true for many states, especially in the western part of the United States. But also the geography is more in terms of the distance between cities. So you can have a reasonable-sized city like Stevens Point and a reasonable-sized city like Green Bay, but they're pretty far apart. And so the ability to have a interim spot where the families can go to be seen by telepsychiatry, even from smaller cities like that, I think is an advantage.
We're talking with Dr. Richard Barthel right now. He's a child psychiatrist and assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We're talking about the rise of telepsychiatry. And Dr. Barthel, why are the numbers of people going into psychiatry diminishing right now?
Actually, I don't think they're diminishing. I think it rises and falls about a pretty steady number over time. The fact that the dilemma is that the number of medical students across the country has been increasing over time, and it's still a shortage because of the increasing population. And in mental health in general, the number of clients or patients, however you want to identify the person who needs help, is larger because of a number of new observations about the kind of mental health interventions that can be helpful, and people who are frankly, greater stress in their environment than they have been before. So I guess if you take the statistics that increasing number of patients, fixed number of physicians, fixed number of mental health people across the board, less ability to train people because of the cost of training, it becomes a gap over time.
Now, what role is the Affordable Care Act playing in the demand for mental health care?
That's a very complex question and a very complex answer. I can't speak to that very much because I don't have a lot of involvement with adult care. In fact, I've not seen adults for clinical care for a number of decades. And by and large, children have been covered in this country by all of the same features of the Affordable Care Act through the use of Medicaid and other state programs that provide care for children. That's the child exception that's always been worked out in the federal government on a regular basis to provide that care. So, for example, the majority of the patients that I see are insured by Medicaid, Title 19 in the state of Wisconsin. And the dilemma there is that I can see them because the contract that my medical school has with the clinic allows me to be paid whether the patients show up or not. But in fact, for the average person in a private practice, they're not going to get reimbursed enough by Medicaid to be able to see families significantly. They can see a portion of those, but if they want to keep an office open, they can't get reimbursed enough to provide the care.
Now, one way that has been floated to help sort of bridge this coverage gap for mental health in Wisconsin is to embed psychiatric services within other medical services, maybe with a primary care doctor. How would that work?
It works pretty well, actually, as long as you can have the right mix of people. Generally, the studies that I'm aware of, and University at UW and Madison have been sort of pioneers in this, they have had usually a non-physician psychotherapist and or social worker and or psychologist who's in the clinic full-time, and then a psychiatrist physician who's there part-time, and the consultations are done through the non-physician to the physician or to the physician to the primary care physician, whether that be a family practice doctor or an internal medicine or pediatric doctor. And if you have good receptivity of the primary care clinicians, they're going to be able to learn something and feel more comfortable with a broader array of patients that they can manage. The Medical College of Wisconsin, as you probably are aware, got a significant funding from the state over the last couple of budget cycles to be able to do this for the northern part of the state, and have been expanding that program as funds become available so that we can contact pediatricians at a distance by telemedicine or by telephone, so they can get consultations. And this is modeled on programs that have been successful in other states, particularly Massachusetts.
How optimistic are you right now that telepsychiatry is going to be enough to bridge this coverage gap that we're talking about in the face of some shortages right now?
Oh, I'm not optimistic at all. It's really not an answer for the coverage gap except geographically, because every patient I see at a distance is one that I can't see in my office in Milwaukee. In fact, I don't have an office in Milwaukee, but I gave up my practice in Milwaukee in order to support the Fox Valley. And so patients who would love to be able to see a child psychiatrist in Milwaukee, you know, two blocks from where they live, don't have somebody that they can see anymore because I'm not in my office. And instead, I'm seeing patients at a distance. So it's been called in the literature a zero-sum game because you don't get any more patients that are being seen. You just change the geography of the patients and their travel time.
Dr. Barthel, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been listening to an interview with Dr. Richard Barthel, child psychiatrist and assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He practices telepsychiatry, one effort to solve a shortage of mental health care providers in rural Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert. Wisconsin incarcerates black men and Native American men at the highest rate in the country. Half of all black 30-year-old men in Milwaukee have spent time in prison. With a similar population and demographic to Minnesota, Wisconsin has twice the prison population.
Prison reform advocates argue that these kinds of incarceration levels don't just affect the people behind bars, but also hurt communities throughout the state and cost Wisconsin millions of dollars. The faith-based grassroots organization Wisdom set out in 2012 to reduce the state's prison population by half by the end of 2015. As we near the end of 2015, that number hasn't fallen, but they aren't giving up.
Wisdom is launching a new campaign called Rock Wisconsin, or Restore Our Communities, with a focus on the various ways that mass incarceration affects communities across the state.
Here with us now to talk about that campaign is David Liners, Executive Director of Wisdom. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, take us back to the origins of Wisdom. How did the group first become involved in trying to reform corrections here in the state?
We started off actually in Milwaukee with MICA, Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Allied for Hope, actually trying to deal with problems of neighborhood violence. And we soon realized it had a lot to do with drugs. We started working on, you know, things to close down drug houses and then realized, you know, the problem wasn't the supply, it was the demand. So we started realizing that we really needed to deal with, you know, not just locking up the kid on the corner. There would just be a new kid on the corner, and all that having a criminal justice solution to a public health issue was doing was creating an even larger problem. So it sort of evolved. It evolved from people saying, "What's going on in my neighborhood?" to really realizing, you know, kind of some of the deeper effects, and then also just the effects that it's having on a lot of our communities where so many people are missing, and so many people, when they come back from prison, are having a very hard time making a go of it.
And what role does faith play in the work that you do in this coalition of faith organizations?
Sure. We're of many different faith traditions. We're kind of from all over the board. We're everyone from Buddhists to Lutherans to Jewish congregations to Catholics, you name it. And this really is a matter of values. It's really a matter of what do we think ought to happen to people who perhaps are having a difficult time in our society, people who have a hard time conforming to the way that we want things to go. Is it, you know, are we really just about punishing and pushing people down? Or all of our faith traditions say, no, the role of the community is to uplift. The role of the community is to restore people, restore families, restore people to health. So our members, though we come from a lot of different traditions, are really motivated by those kind of values and really on a deep spiritual level for most of them.
When we think of people who are in prison, we usually tend to think of those people themselves and what life might be like behind bars. As we mentioned at the outset, you're making the case that there's also an absence here. All these people in prison are not at home in their communities. What does that do to those kids growing up there, to the people who are left behind?
It has a tremendous impact on children. It can create, you know, it can create an expectation that this is what we do, this is what happens. There's all kinds of studies, there's all kinds of empirical proof that, you know, when you incarcerate the parent, the chances of their child growing up to be incarcerated are greater. Families are divided. It's really, really expensive to have a loved one in prison. Everything from the cost of phone calls, and usually they're very far away. You know, our prisons tend not to be in the same communities where the imprisoned people come from. There's all kinds of travel involved. It's expensive to buy things in prison. Of course, you're dealing without the income from one of the adults in the family. So there's all kinds of ways that it just has just terribly negative effects on everybody around, on children, on partners, on neighbors.
Talking to David Liners, executive director of the group Wisdom, about an effort to reduce mass incarceration here in Wisconsin. And David, we mentioned Wisconsin disproportionate compared to a state like our neighbors in Minnesota, disproportionate number of people incarcerated. How did we get here?
It's been through a lot of little steps. I think the fast answer to it is we got here because we, the citizens, let it happen. We thought we were trading safety for the costs of incarceration, and in fact, it didn't make us any safer. So it's a lot of things. It's a lot of little changes in laws. Truth in sentencing has had a lot to do with it. That was a big change in laws. I think it has to do with defunding a lot of the alternatives that that people have, defunding some of the kinds of programs, some of the things for youth that help to keep people out. So it's been a sort of gradual. It took us about 25 years to get there. It's part of a national movement. Some of it is kind of a greatly overdone war on drugs that really just served to incarcerate people rather than to help them be fixed. So it was a lot of small steps. It wasn't one thing. And it's the same thing with the solution. There's not one thing that's going to be the solution. We need to do a lot of things, but we need to first start by just changing the attitudes.
Well, let's get into those solutions now. This new effort is called Restore Our Communities. And I know one focus here is on parole and the way it works in Wisconsin. What are you looking to change?
So there's two things that are kind of parole related. One of the things is we still have 3,000 people in our state prisons who were sentenced back in the last century, before truth in sentencing came online, who are people who are eligible for parole. They're still under the old system. Under truth in sentencing, there is no such thing as getting out early on parole. But these people, and they're stuck. They're stuck in an incredibly dysfunctional system. So that's one way. We literally have almost 3,000 people who are not actually getting a chance to earn their freedom, as was envisioned by the judge who sentenced them long, long ago. A lot of these people were teenagers when the crime committed. Now they're in their 40s. And that's one of the areas where people just need a chance to be able to get back to their families, to get back to their life while they still have a life left. The other thing that would be parole-related or supervision-related has to do with people being revoked back to prison because of rule violations. That's something we're really, really concerned about. When a person is released from prison and they're on extended supervision, they can be sent back to prison for any number of pretty minor things. And about half of our prison admissions every year are people who actually are not being readmitted because of being convicted of a new crime. They're being readmitted because they failed something. They may have failed a drug test. They may have missed meetings. They may have left the county without asking permission first. Those kinds of things. There's some really common sense ways that we could have a lot less people in prison and really strive a lot more to help people get better, help people get back into the community more effectively.
Well, you'll, of course, run into concerns from the public about safety, and one objection might be if someone on parole can't follow the rules of their parole, why should we expect that they're going to follow the law? Are they likely to recommit crimes? Maybe we're safer if those parole violators do end up back in prison.
Yeah, a couple of answers to that. One is that there's just simply no proof of that. There's no correlation between people committing any kind of serious crimes. There are other states that don't go over the top the way we do in terms of numbers of revocations. Their crime rates among their recidivism rates are no higher than ours. So that it's simply on the face of it, fact-wise, just simply not true. The other thing is there's other kinds of sanctions. We don't have to have the same thing. I mean, there's ways to have sanctions for people who break rules. But the final thing I would say is some of these are rules. There's so many rules, it would be almost impossible for you or me to keep them all. And yet we're expecting people who are under a lot of stress, trying to put their lives back together, to keep all kinds of rules that most of us wouldn't be able to.
Let's talk about that stress of coming out of prison, readjusting to life outside of prison. That's another part of your effort on a theoretical level, trying to get people, I think the phrase is to treat ex-inmates as humans, with humanity, and on a more practical level to help them adjust, find jobs, housing, things like that. Where are you focusing your efforts?
Yeah, so we actually have a group that we're very, very proud of in Wisdom that calls itself EXPO, Ex-Prisoners Organizing, that really are forming their own organization within our organization in collaboration with the rest of us. And, yeah, we need all kinds of ways for people coming home from jail or prison to have a chance to do well. One of the things we need is for people to be able to get a job. We need to remove all kinds of the restrictions that are on people in terms of the kinds of jobs that they can get and the kinds of licenses they can get. We certainly need to get, you know, the ban the box to become a universal thing. Just get it off the front page of job applications. Don't make the first question, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Because that's just signaling that this is the first screen in terms of whether you're going to get a job. So we need people to be able to get jobs. There's all kinds of issues about housing. There's a lot of things. I mean, all the way down to, you know, someday we'd love to be able to kind of work on being able to get people their right back to vote as soon as they get out of prison and not have to wait for years and years while they're on supervision. But the biggest thing we want to change is, frankly, the way people see people who have a conviction history. They're people who perhaps made a mistake at one point in their life. They're not people who are forever to be shunned. They're not people who are forever to be at the back of the line. Folks have a lot to offer our community, and they want to offer it. And we just need to make the paths for it. We need to make it possible for people to go to school, for people to be able to live in decent housing, for people to be able to get jobs, and for people just to simply be able to live as the rest of us live.
We're talking to David Liners, Executive Director of Wisdom, a statewide network of faith-based organizations working for social justice, talking about their new campaign against mass incarceration in the state called ROC, that's Restore Communities, Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support attempts to reduce the state's prison population? Have you, a friend or family member, had experiences with the correction system? How has it affected you or your community? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with David Liners, Executive Director of Wisdom, a statewide network of faith-based organizations, about their new campaign against mass incarceration in the state called Rock Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support efforts to reduce Wisconsin's prison population? Do you have any personal experiences with the correction system, examples of how it might affect a community? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got David on the line in La Crosse. David, hi.
Hi. My question is for the guest. Has there been any talk or chance of going back to the old law when they still had parole? I was in prison back then, and I tell you, a lot of guys, they thought twice about acting out in their old ways if they knew they had a parole hearing coming up, or they might get out a little sooner.
David, thanks a lot for that call. So David Liners, the idea of parole, pre-truth and sentencing as an incentive for better behavior.
Absolutely. That's something that we need to go back to. Your caller is absolutely right that right now someone in prison has no particular incentive to kind of do things the right way. I mean, most people actually still do, kind of amazingly, but now, though, under truth and sentencing, it doesn't matter. You could win the Nobel Peace Prize. It doesn't win you a day. So, we need to go back to providing people an incentive, a chance to work. I think truth and sentencing, you know, so-called, it's another kind of sign of hopelessness. It's saying there's nothing you can do. There's nothing we can do. We don't really believe in corrections and rehabilitation. And we just believe that's wrong. We believe people can and do change.
David, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Chuck on the line in Green Bay. Chuck, hi. Chuck, are you
Hello?
There? Yeah, you're on the air, Chuck.
Yeah, okay. My son is currently incarcerated. It was drug-related charges. And he had gotten an unbelievable sentence for it. But, you know, it is what it is. You know, we understand that. But they put him in a maximum security prison for, you know, three times, three different prisons. And then, you know, his charges was not violent at all. There was no violence or anything else. And then when he got into this last prison, which is in Oshkosh, they said, well, you can get out in April, but you have to have a job. And now how is he supposed to get a job if he's incarcerated?
Chuck,
I don't understand that.
Chuck, thanks for the call. Is this David Liner's often a condition of release, having a job lined up?
For parole-eligible people, yes. Often enough it is, and sometimes it's a matter of housing. They have to have a place to stay, and as Chuck is saying, sometimes, you know, we create nearly impossible situations for people. And also, just Chuck's point about people being in maximum security who don't belong in maximum security, kind of conditions in prison. We really need to view these as places for people to get better, to get healed, to be restored and returned to the community. And we're just simply not doing that right now as a state. And it's costing us tremendously. It's costing families like Chuck's. It's costing the inmates, but it's costing all of us.
And Chuck mentioned this being a drug crime. I know there have been efforts at diversion saying, okay, instead of a court that sends you to prison, that's their only alternative. Drug courts, addiction courts, alcohol courts, that sort of thing. Is that something you see as part of the solution?
Absolutely. We know we have a lot of alternative programs in Wisconsin, and they all work, and they work pretty well. And the problem is they're all underfunded. We have a whole lot more capacity. We actually did a study back in 2013 that kind of showed we could actually send 3,000 people less per year to our state prisons and 21,000, I think it was, less to county jails if we maxed out on diversion programs. If everybody who was eligible, that is, nonviolent people who have a mental health or substance abuse issue, were sent into alternative programming, we could cut down our prison population pretty dramatically. And there's a lot of people that just don't belong there in the first place.
Talking to David Liners, executive director of the group Wisdom, about the organization's Rock Wisconsin campaign, that's Restore Our Communities, looking at mass incarceration and maybe solutions to that issue here in Wisconsin. Back to our callers now. We've got Troy on the line in DeForest. Troy, hi.
Hi there. I'm a former correctional officer, and I noticed that the guest was talking about how people are basically getting sent back to prison for breaking their probation, for failing their drug tests, or leaving the county without supervision. And I guess I want to hear what his alternatives are, just because in prison, life is it's basically very structured. And when you come out of prison, you need that structure. And I feel like having those rules of probation is something to ease them back into life in normal society.
Troy, I got you. Your line's breaking up there a little. But David, these rules of probation are there for a reason, he's saying. They give structure and some boundaries as someone comes out of prison.
And Troy is absolutely right. It's really hard to come out of prison, and it's really hard to kind of suddenly take responsibility for everything in your life when you've had all responsibility taken away from you. You've had a decision-making ability taken away. So, yes, there needs to be structure. But what we don't need is for the sanctions to be over the top. We don't need the sanctions to be huge. You know, one of the things that drug treatment courts use at the front end is they call it graduated sanctions and graduated rewards. It's like little by little. If you break a rule, yeah, there's a penalty, but the penalty isn't you're going back to prison for a year and a half. The penalty might be that you have to come in again tomorrow, and there are the penalty might be that you have to take extra drug tests, or you have to go to meetings, or you have to do something. There's a lot of other things we can do other than just automatically default to we're just going to lock you back up for an extended period of time and make you lose your job and move you away from your family again.
Troy, thanks for that call. Time for one more brief call. Lou is with us in Appleton. Lou, hi.
Yes. I'm a member of an organization here in the Fox Valley called Circles of Support, which is funded through a Department of Correction grant, and it's coordinated by Goodwill Industries. And we we help those recently incarcerated people that are coming out of our prison systems to, you know, we assist them in navigating when they get back into the real world. So my point is, I think as a society, we need more of those types of organizations that help people come out and readjust to life, the real life of living in their communities.
Lou, thanks a lot for that call. As we wrap up, David, are we seeing more efforts like that around the state?
There's a lot of people making a lot of efforts, and circles of support are really a terrific thing. Again, it's all way too small. The scale is way, way, way too small. There's a lot of people falling through the cracks. There's a lot of people that we're not reaching. So we just really, really need to redouble efforts on to keep people out of prison, to help people who are in prison get transitioned back as quickly and as well as possible, and then to really provide supports for people when they come home.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to David Liners, Executive Director of Wisdom, a statewide network of faith-based organizations working for social justice, looking at their new campaign against mass incarceration here in the state. So this weekend, I went down to St. Louis for some soccer-related tourism with my family. On the way back, we stopped at the Cahokia Mounds State Historic Site. Have you been there?
I have, and it's an incredible place. I remember climbing so many steps up to this the top of the flat-topped hill.
Monk's Mound, I know it's called now.
There you go. And they say that like 10,000 people would be up there taking part in games and markets and other community life.
And this is the largest, the significance here, largest pre-Columbian settlement, pre-European contact settlement north of Mexico on the entire, you know, North and South American half of the world. Mm-hmm. So this was a big deal and a big Wisconsin connection.
Right. And I remember, did they say that they're not sure why people left Cahokia?
Right. It's a mystery. Yeah. And there's some mysteries here, too, because this culture, the Mississippian culture, mm-hmm. spread up here, Aztalan, one
right.
site.
And in Trempealeau also. And there were UW archaeologists working with community members there in Trempealeau to trace a settlement where people came up the Mississippi River and settled there.
And that's another mystery because they don't know. These were like elites. These were, you right. know, upper class, whatever the equivalent was in Cahokian culture.
Right.
Why did they come up?
Right.
We don't know. So there's this great community. We had one of the archaeologists on Central Time.
Right.
Might be a time for a revisit.
Sounds like it, because that's a really exciting project.
Yep. So, yeah, Cahokia. Check it out, and we'll look more into what's going on in Wisconsin.